I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Laura and Ellen Distelheim, daughters of Rachel Distelheim, the late author of the new book, Jerusalem as a Second Language. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I promised you a couple of weeks ago here on Two Jewish that I'd talk about the Nobel Prizes, which were announced over the last month and featured Jewish winners in several categories. This shouldn't come as a surprise to any Two Jewish listeners. We've been reporting over the years on the consistently amazing number of Jewish Nobel laureates in the 115 years they've been awarding the various prizes. Remarkably, while we Jews make up quite a bit under 0.25% of the entire population of the world, well over 20% of all Nobel Prizes have been awarded to Jews. This can't be attributed to philo-Semitism or pro-Jewish bias on the part of the Swedish Academy that awards the Nobels, since there have never been many Jews in Scandinavia, nor was Alfred Nobel, the benefactor of the Nobel Prizes, Jewish or related to Jews himself. He did invent dynamite, however. Anyway, this Jewish prevalence is about winning the highest awards given in this world solely on merit. And this year is no exception. Among the Nobel Prize winners this year, there were 11 individuals who received the awards, plus one organization. And they included the Jewish Laureate for Physiology or Medicine, Laureate Harvey J. Alter, the Literature Laureate, poet Louise Gluck, and the Economics Laureate, Paul Milgram. In addition, the 2020 Physics Laureates, Roger Penrose and Andrea Gies, are of Jewish heritage by matrilineal and patrilineal descent, respectively. Penrose is an atheist who doesn't consider himself Jewish, but his mother was. Anyway, that means that this year, out of 11 people, three are clearly Jewish, while two of the three physics Nobel laureates are descended from Jews and could be classified as, borderline Jews or kind of Jewish. That is, depending on how you do your counting, at least 27% of this year's laureates are Jewish, or perhaps as much as 45% of this year's Nobel laureates are Jewish. That is a little above average, but in keeping with, what we've seen over the years. So what can we attribute this preposterous overrepresentation of our co-religionists among the absolutely elite physicists, chemists, authors, medical researchers, economists, and peacemakers to? In purely mathematical terms, it makes very little sense. There are at most 18 million Jews in the world out of a total population of 7.8 billion. That's less than a quarter of 1%. To put it another way, there have been over 900 Nobel Prize winners since the first laureates were announced near the beginning of the 20th century. We Jews are just 0.2% of the global population, so we should have won exactly two Nobel Prizes. We have won 218. The U.S. has about 330 million people. Our Jewish population is somewhere between 6 and 7 million here, about 2%, and yet we've accounted for 36% of the Nobels ever won by Americans. And by the way, not counted in those figures are the organizations that have won Nobel Peace Prizes and were founded by Jews, including UNICEF, Amnesty International, Doctors Without Borders, known in French, by the way, as Médecins Sans Frontières, or, that's my bad French. So over 20% of all organizations that have received the Nobel Peace Prize were founded or co-founded by Jews, too. Simply put, why so many Nobel laureate Jews? To start with, Nobel Prizes are won, generally speaking, by the ridiculously brilliant and supremely educated geniuses of our world, and it's rather difficult to win one if you don't have a first-class education. For many years, Jews were excluded from the best universities in the world, or restricted by quotas from attending in proportion to our abilities. But education has always been an incredibly high priority in nearly every Jewish home. When much of the world was illiterate, we were producing libraries of great works. And when higher education became available to Jews, we surged into academia and rose to its highest levels rapidly and in large numbers. But it's not just education. The truth is that Jews have long had an outsider's view of society, and in order to succeed, have always felt a need to see things in new and creative ways. You don't win a Nobel Prize simply by doing a great job of conventional research or writing or diplomatic work. You have to be willing to think outside the box, to test radical new theories, to see what others fail to see, to seek to understand what many miss. You have to take the chance that others will see your work as revolutionary in a bad way, or simply wrong, that you may even be ridiculed or attacked. You have to be willing to leave the steady shores of the known to explore the open frontiers of the unknown. And you have to show great tenacity and dedication to your theories and to your work, to have great integrity to your creativity in the face of harsh criticism. You don't win a Nobel Prize by accident, whether you are Albert Einstein, Milton Friedman, Arno Penzias — his daughter was in rabbinical school with me long ago, by the way — Elie Wiesel, or even Bob Dylan, for that matter. We Jews are, of course, known for our willingness to pursue our own views of the world, whether we are in the majority — well, that only happens in Israel, really — or almost all the time when we're in the minority. And that means that we have a kind of unusual advantage in seeking our own very own place in the intellectual and creative world. I'm not saying that this Nobel phenomenon is necessarily going to continue forever, although it shows no current signs of diminishing, but I am saying there's something in Jewish culture and civilization that helps those who are brilliant and talented and motivated to use all of that and rise to uniquely extraordinary heights. So, Mazel Tov to our 2020 Nobel Jewish laureates. May it continue for a while yet. To play us in this morning, in a little of the spirit of leaving the known for the unknown, here's a delightful Yiddish song called Leaving Odessa, first written by Pesach Burstein and a recording by Olga Avigail Milichik.
Велик бен кен момоте моя Эх, Одесса, прощай, Одесса Ирнук дир велик бен кен горе не беда Эх, Одесса, прощай, Одесса Прощай, ты в ребята, кричит и всех ура Мир волен зигдуен, вера буржуен Эх, Одесса, мама, я люблю тебя Ир волтахит гетлойген, налштейтит фарди ойген Артисты молдаванка, эрмит дер ганцуха Gehen mit die Krillen, das Schönige Mamsellen, in die Traktieren trinkt man sich dort schall. Die Appen von Robben, wo es geht bis von Toben, die Wanzelech verdreht und die Schubschicke in der Bock. Kleben fast und trinkt man, nur lehnlich dort singt man, in die Gassen tanzt man, nur es geht ganz ein Schall. Ребята, кричите всех ура! Мир волен всех дуен, виолем
That was the festive tune, Leaving Odessa. We'll return in a moment here on Two Jewish, our guests, Laura and Ellen Distelheim, daughters of the late author Rochelle Distelheim, whose book, Jerusalem, a Second Language, has just been published. We'll explore their late mom's writing influences and choices. It's a first for Two Jewish, children of an author who has passed away, may her memory be a blessing, just before her book came out. Meet them when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. You can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha weekly on Friday night for masked blended Shabbat services, or on Facebook Live, where everybody can come. If you wish to come in person, you may call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675 to request attendance. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus, Soros, you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. The Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We're holding our services with full music on Facebook Live and for very limited attendance. Live people wearing masks and social distancing as well. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, with a few select ones also available in blended format. You can access our classes by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Or going to our website, beitsimchatucson.org. Synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend our wonderful services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, now also in blended formats, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses. Those are all taught on Zoom and some in blended format as well. And of course, all of our services on Facebook Live or in blended format. Go to BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community and the fastest growing synagogue in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guests this morning. Lauren and Ellen Distelheim are the daughters of Rochelle Distelheim, the author of Jerusalem as a Second Language. I have to admit, this is the first time in all the years I've done Too Jewish I've interviewed the children of the author of a book. Sadly, after completing the book, before it was published, Rochelle passed away. May her memory be a blessing, earlier this year. Good morning, Lauren and Ellen, and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
So, starting question, can you tell us why your mother decided to write about the experience of immigration to Israel from a Russian Jewish perspective?
What she told me when I asked her about this is that she had been traveling in Israel as a tourist, and she noticed a lot of groups of immigrants from the former Soviet Union, and she began to think about how difficult it would be for someone to move from a society where being Jewish was so dangerous to one where their Judaism was not only accepted, it was assumed. And she, when she came home, she just, that thought just stayed with her, and she began to ponder it, and then this character of Manya came to her mind, and then her voice began to come to her mind, and she felt like she had to tell the story.
She's such a vivid character, and, you know, I lived in Israel 91, 92, shortly after the huge wave of Russian immigration took place, and this book struck a lot of interesting chords. A key to the book is the marital conflict between a suddenly religious Baal Tshuva husband and his wife and daughter and other people. This is a fascinating ongoing struggle. Where did she get the information to explore this?
Well, one reason I think she was interested in that issue is that she had grown up with it. Her father was raised in an extremely observant home, and her mother was much less so. And so she had always been intrigued by how they made that compromise.
Also, in her own life, interestingly, she was far more observant than was our father, so that she had the same conflict both in her childhood and her adult life. Although she was very culturally Jewish and made a big deal about all the holidays and felt very, very connected to her Judaism, my father was much more observant than she was. So it was a conflict that was very much alive in her own life.
For two generations. Now I'm going to ask if you guys have had any of the same experience. Maybe this goes into your family.
In my experience with my husband, we're both Reformed, and I think it was our observance was fairly equal.
Little easier experience,
right? We do not have that conflict.
I understand.
In this generation.
But boy, it's fascinating how it's played out in the book. We will talk much more with Lauren and Ellen Distelheim, the daughters of Rochelle Distelheim. The book is called Jerusalem as a Second Language. It's a great read, and we'll hear more about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, with over 100,000 downloads. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we always talk about international places, some extraordinarily far-flung. We have never done this before on Too Jewish, so it's a novel experience, a Shehechianu moment, if you will.
Right.
But we're going to talk about an American Jewish community, the one you grew up in, St. Louis.
Right. And I just returned from there yesterday, where I visit my 93-year-old mother on as regular a basis as possible. So this is not the case here in Tucson, where you and I have the good fortune to live. But on the East Coast, A lot of people are surprised when they learn that there are Jews west of the Hudson or west of New Jersey. And they sort of think, St. Louis has Jews? Well, when I grew up, the community there was about 75,000. With all the branches of Judaism were represented, except maybe back then, and we're talking a long time ago because I'm old, right? Maybe there was no Reconstructionist congregation, but there was everything else.
And also I should note the affiliation rate in the Midwest is much higher than many other parts of the country. It can be 70-80% of people belong to a synagogue, for example.
At least. And also, I mean, one of the big differences, I wouldn't say between St. Louis and other Jewish communities in the United States, but between the 50s and 60s when I was growing up and today, is that the different movements of Judaism, particularly the mainstream movements, Orthodoxy, Conservative Judaism, Reform Judaism, used to do things together. They did lots of joint activities, particularly when it involved something that was more civic than religious. Like there was a sort of interdenominational Thanksgiving Day service that was held in an Orthodox synagogue, but because it wasn't really a Jewish service, they dropped the requirement for a mechitza.
So men and women sat together
right,
for the experience, right?
Right. And I remember an abundance of those things. When the Six-Day War broke out and there were major fundraisers because it looked like Israel's very existence was threatened, those fundraisers were also interdenominational, as it were. But the other thing that I think is very distinctive about the Jewish community in St. Louis is it's pretty old. It goes back to the mid-19th century, and there are families where it's not uncommon to have a fourth-generation friendship in the same family. So in other words, I had dinner on Monday night with a friend with whom I grew up in our congregation. His parents were close friends with my parents, and his grandmother played volleyball with my grandmother in the early 1930s when our parents were in the same elementary school, and these two ladies, long deceased now, were active in the Mother's Club. So that you find, I mean, story after, even in my own family, there's many, many fourth-generation friendships because the community is pretty stable. And most Jews in St. Louis find their niche. Sometimes they straddle like two different congregations and two different streams of Jewish practice. So they have one foot in two camps, as it were. But they're happy with whatever solution they find.
Very interesting, because those multi-generational, you know, Jewish communities are now so mobile, and people move all over the country, all over the world, unless they're in one of the mega Jewish communities like New York or Los Angeles or perhaps Chicago. It's interesting to think about, you know, a stable, long-term, deep Jewish community like St. Louis, not so typically understood in America today.
Right.
Tom, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A cantor goes to the psychiatrist and tells him, "Doctor, it bothers me so much. Every night, every single night, I have the same dream." And the psychiatrist says, "So, chazan, what do you dream?" And the cantor says, "Every night I dream I'm reading the Torah, chanting from the Torah." And the psychiatrist says, "Every night you dream you're reading the Torah? It's always the same dream?" The cantor says, "Yes, every night I dream I'm reading the Torah." And the psychiatrist says, "Don't you ever dream about women?" And the cantor says, "What? And lose my place in the Torah?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Lech Lecha, including God's great commandment to Abraham. Lech Lecha me'artzecha u'mimoladetcha u'mibeit avicha. Leave, go from your country and your homeland and the house of your father to a land that I will show you. It's the very beginning of monotheism, of the belief in one God. It is the beginning of Judaism, and it will prove to be the beginning of our connection to the land of Israel as well. It's a dramatic and powerful moment in the Torah. The fascinating thing about Lech Lecha is not that God commands Abram, later to be known as Abraham, to leave everything he has known. After all, if he is going to create a new religion and remake belief in our world, he will need to leave polytheism and a pagan society that doesn't recognize the concept of supreme justice or divine power, a corrupt, dishonest, ethically failed civilization. If you want to live a life of goodness and blessing, sometimes you need to leave home in order to do it. So Abraham picked up and left the sophisticated, morally challenged city-states of Babylon. He journeyed outward to find God and to found a new religion. That journey of differentiation was pivotal to all human history. If Abraham didn't do what God commanded, well, there would be no Judaism, or Christianity, or Islam, or monotheism, or Western civilization at all. But what's most fascinating about Abraham's actions in this week's Torah portion of Lech Lecha is that after God commands him to go, he simply goes without argument or controversy. That strikes me as a rather un-Jewish approach. After all, the essence of Jewish culture seems to be argument and discussion. If you were directed to leave everything you had ever known and told to move somewhere unspecified, wouldn't you complain at least a little? And don't think for a moment Abraham is incapable of arguing with God. In fact, he will prove in next week's Torah portion that he will argue and bargain with God to the last degree, as he does in trying to defend the few righteous people of Sodom and Gomorrah. No, something else is at work here. The essential understanding that occasionally you just have to move on. Leave what you know and embrace the journey. In order to fully realize who we can become, we must first leave who we have been. It's an exciting, exhilarating, daunting prospect, dangerous, yet essential. But if we can choose to take the first steps, we, like Abraham, may reap rich rewards. When we return on to Jewish, our guests, Laura and Ellen Distelheim, daughters of the late author Rochelle Distelheim, whose new book, Jerusalem, a Second Language, has just come out, will explore the connections between their mother's long and fruitful life and her new novel. Join them when we return on to Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Saeb Erekat is in critical condition at an Israeli hospital after being diagnosed with COVID-19. Erekat, who served as the chief negotiator for the Palestinian Liberation Organization for decades, was admitted to Hadassah Ein Karim in Jerusalem last week after a Palestinian Authority request. A statement from the hospital said the 65-year-old is in critical condition and is on a ventilator. Because of the chronic health problems in Erekat's respiratory system, he's being transferred to a hospital in the 1948 areas because his condition requires special medical attention and supervision, said the PLO Negotiation Affairs Department, neglecting to mention that it was actually in the State of Israel. Erekat was diagnosed with COVID-19 earlier this month. He is considered especially vulnerable because he received a lung transplant in 2017. The Palestinian Authority cut ties with Israel and the U.S. back in February after rejecting the peace plan presented by U.S. President Donald Trump, with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas calling it a disgrace. However, as is typical, when Palestinian leaders have medical needs, they go to top Israeli hospitals, as do many prominent leaders throughout the Arab world, including many who do not accept Israel's existence. Eric Kot joins a list that includes prominent Hamas terrorists and Arab rejectionists of other stripes who have been treated in Israeli hospitals successfully and compassionately in recent years. In Paris, French Chief Rabbi Chaim Korsia praised his government's crackdown on radical Islamists, writing in an op-ed that it makes clear that things are changing, belatedly, but all the same. Korsia's op-ed last week in Le Figaro followed news that the French Interior Ministry has dissolved the Hamas front group as part of a slew of actions prompted by the October 16th beheading of a history teacher near Paris. The teacher, Samuel Paty, was murdered by a Muslim refugee from Chechnya after showing his students the same caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad that prompted the deadly assault on the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine back in 2015. There are no lone wolves. There is no auto-indoctrination, Korsia wrote. On the contrary, the spirit of those made-in-France terrorists is part of an elevation of heroes, an affinity for horror, a glorification guaranteed by a multinational of fanatics. That is what's being targeted. The Hamas Front, Collectif Sheikh Yassin, was named for one of the founders of Hamas, killed in an Israeli airstrike in 2014. Several suspected Islamists have also been arrested by French authorities, and at least one mosque was temporarily shuttered. Even before Paty's murder, French President Emmanuel Macron had announced a plan that he called an attack on Islamist separatism, and which aimed to ban underground Muslim schools, among other venues of Islamist indoctrination that Macron said endanger the integrity of the Republic. In Germany, less than a year after it spurred widespread Jewish condemnation for selling Nazi memorabilia, a Munich auction house is selling several manuscripts written by Adolf Hitler. The European Jewish Association blasted Hermann Historica over the Hitler papers it has on the block. Many are notes written before infamous speeches the Nazi leader gave in the 1930s. It defies logic, decency, and humanity for the very same auction house that came under fire less than a year ago for selling disgusting lots of Nazi memorabilia that they should do so again, said Rabbi Menachem Margolin, head of the Brussels-based Jewish organization. I cannot get my head around the sheer irresponsibility and insensitivity in such a febrile climate of selling items such as the ramblings of the world's biggest killer of Jews to the highest bidder. Last November, this same house auctioned 10 items that belonged to Hitler, including a top hat and other Nazi memorabilia, such as a silver-plated copy of Mein Kampf that once belonged to senior Nazi Hermann Göring. A Lebanese-Swiss businessman bought all the items and donated them to Keren Hayesod United Israel Appeal, an international organization that raises funds for Israel. The European Jewish Association has been lobbying European lawmakers to ban the sale of Nazi memorabilia. In Austria, which has never truly acknowledged its deep Nazi past and collaboration, the Vienna city government moved to protect a statue of a former mayor who was a virulent anti-Semite. It erected fencing recently around the statue of Karl Lueger, aimed at preventing protesters from continuing to spray graffiti calling for its removal. The municipality cleaned the statue on the Austrian capital's central Ringstrasse Boulevard earlier this month. Lueger served as mayor of Vienna for 13 years until his death in 1910 at the age of 65. He was known for vicious anti-Semitic rhetoric that inspired Adolf Hitler, who lived in Vienna as a young man, and wrote in Mein Kampf that he had undisguised admiration for Lueger. This statue belongs on the manure heap of history, or in a ugly museum, Simon Nagy, an artist who helped start a vigil in protest of the statue and the municipality's plan for cleaning it, said. And in New York City, with tensions still high between ultra-Orthodox Jews and New York City officials, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio expressed regret for how he had handled a large Hasidic funeral during the pandemic's early days. Back in April, after a funeral for a local rabbi in Brooklyn drew thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews, Haredim, into the streets of Williamsburg, de Blasio visited the scene himself and called out the Jewish community, unquote. His tweet was widely criticized and damaged what had been a relatively close relationship between the mayor and the city's ultra-Orthodox community. Now, with Haredi neighborhoods again among the city's virus hotspots, and residents chafing at restrictions imposed to curb the disease's spread, de Blasio regrets what he said. I look back now and understand there was just more dialogue that was needed, de Blasio said. I certainly got very frustrated when I saw large groups of people still out without masks, and I think more dialogue would have been better. I certainly want to express my regret that I didn't figure out how to do that better. That one night in Williamsburg, I let my frustration and concern get away with me. I should have been more careful in my language. I've expressed my apology for that before. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guests this morning. Lauren and Ellen Distelheim are the daughters of Rochelle Distelheim, the author of the book Jerusalem as a Second Language, which is just published. It was completed earlier this year, and unfortunately Rochelle passed away before it could be published, and otherwise we'd be speaking to her, and as her daughter said, they'd much rather I was talking to her, but it's a pleasure speaking to them. As we spoke about a little bit earlier in the show, this is a very Russian-Jewish book, reflecting both the culture of Jewish life in the collapsing and collapsed Soviet Union and in Israel, where they've moved, and the continuous connections in those communities. How did she do her research on that? Because this is not about, earlier generations. This is really a sharp view of some very challenging period in Russian-Jewish history.
Well, she had relatives who had moved to Israel, and she went back to visit them, and they introduced her to a lot of recent immigrants from the Soviet Union who were willing to sit down and talk with her and share with her a lot of their experiences, both in their former home and in trying to make a home in this new country. And that was really my mother's gift as a writer and as a person, that she was very magnetic, and people were very quick to open up and share their stories with her, and she was fascinated by other people's lives, and so it worked very well for her.
She actually spent quite a bit of time with Olim when she was visiting Israel, and one of my cousins told me the story where they introduced her to a family that lived near the cousins, and she went over to their house and started talking to them, and there was a poignant image of a mother who was there, standing there stirring cabbage soup and taking care of her family. And she had been a physician in the former Soviet Union. So she really heard their whole story and their plight, and it was very real to her. So she did a lot of firsthand research.
You know, there's a vividness to the descriptions of both the positive aspects of the Russian Jewish community and some of the unsavory parts. I wonder how she did the research on that part.
I believe that was also from speaking to many of the immigrants from Russia who told her both the positive and the negative. She heard a lot of stories in great detail, and then she was able to turn them into her novel. But there was a lot of firsthand experiences, so she did feel as if she had done very extensive research by speaking to the people who had lived this.
So your mom published her first novel when she was 90 years old, I believe, called Sadie in Love. That gives all of us writers hope of late success, I think. She had a lot of success in short stories and won awards and stuff. What motivated her to move to novels? Did she ever discuss that with you guys?
Well, she continued to write short stories even after she had published her novel. She really loved doing both, but she had always had the dream of writing a novel, and I think one thing that really inspired her was that Sadie Schuster, who was the protagonist of her first novel, Sadie in Love, was just such a large character to her that she felt like she needed more pages and a more complicated plot and just a wider stage to tell her story on. And so that just evolved from there, and she loved writing that novel, so she went on to write this one. She found a wonderful publisher, Obeyed Publishing, to work with, and that was such a wonderful experience for her. And she never really let the fact that she was 90, she felt that was irrelevant. She was going to write as long as she could, and she felt age just didn't matter, and she loved that inspired other people.
When you guys were growing up, did she frequently write?
She always wrote. We've never I've never have a memory of her not writing, and her characters were always so vivid. She would discuss them with us, and they were almost members of the family. She was always a writer, always a mentor, always believed that you could do anything at any age in your life, and she was very magnetic. So, So she was always, people were always drawn to her, and she was always, she was a born teacher, and she did actually teach creative writing. So she was always writing from the very beginning, and always we always were discussing grammar and language and books at our table, and she was words were always just very important.
Did she ever put either of you guys into any of her stories?
Not that we know of. I can't think of anything directly. There are parts of our personalities that are probably we could see if we looked hard enough in all of her characters, but not directly.
That's probably a relief. I don't know. There's a great deal of continuous tension throughout the book. Your mom did a wonderful job of incorporating all these kind of unexpected twists and turns into a compelling narrative. You don't know what's going to happen next. Did she tell stories as well as write in life?
Well, she did tell stories. I mean, she was a natural storyteller, but I mean, the dramatic tension and the plot twists and turns and intricacies. She worked very hard at that. She was really dedicated to revising and reworking and polishing her work until she had it exactly where she wanted it. So I think a lot of that's a result of the dedication she had to honing her craft, but she definitely was a storyteller spontaneously as well. She saw stories everywhere. She would hear a little bit of a conversation or see an encounter or talk to someone, and it all just came to life for her.
Often when my parents would go out to a party, my mother would come home with just voluminous stories about everybody who was there and every aspect of their life, and she would learn so much about them in such a short period of time. And my father then would look at her and say, did we go to the same party? Because he had picked up none of those stories, and he had not learned anything about any of those people. Everybody was really a potential character in her story. She'd go to the grocery store and the checkout person. She'd come home and take notes and think of stories about their lives. And really, everybody was fair game to be a character. And she was really a natural-born storyteller, very creative and very imaginative.
Is anyone in Jerusalem as a second language recognizable to you guys in real life?
Our mother is very recognizable in both the protagonist in Sadie in Love and Jerusalem as a Second Language. I mean, Sadie was feisty and creative and imaginative, and she was a suffragette and a strong supporter of women's rights. And
Manu was more of a deep thinker, but she was very strong. She would never say yes if she felt no, and she pondered things a lot. And my mother was not ever going to just say yes to make things go along. She wanted to understand why she was making decisions. And so there's a lot of both her characters in her.
Also, we do know several people who have become more religiously observant later in life,
as her husband did in Jerusalem as a Second Language.
So we do see many Yuris.
You know, it's a fascinating phenomenon. I don't know if you see that in Highland Park, but you certainly see it in Jerusalem. There's a passage that I really thought of, which is a very interesting one. Kind of late in the book, she says, why don't men answer questions fully? With the appropriate facial mannerisms, hand gestures, a whole drama expressed by the body as well as by the voice, as women do. Most of the marriages in the world would improve immediately. Mental health among women would shoot up. It's a very funny comment on the difference between men and women.
Yes. My mother was a keen observer of that situation. My father was very much a deep thinker and very quiet. And, partly he was quiet because my mother was talking a lot.
he couldn't get a word in edgewise from time to time. Yeah, that's
right. But she made that comment all the time. And it was sort of a joke in our family as well. But yes, I think that that's a very universal comment, and many of her friends would agree with her. And we do know many people who could have said that quote.
Why can't a man be more like a woman?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It wouldn't make as interesting a novel, but yes, she did believe that.
The characters feel like they should go on to another book. Had she planned any more?
Well, she was in the middle of a third novel, but not about these characters. She was in the middle of a novel about a widower in his 80s living in the Chicago area, which was based on actually a friend of my parents. He was just the seed of the character, but it's a beautiful novel, and we're hoping to maybe have some of the chapters published as short stories. But, yeah, I know we've also felt that Jerusalem could have used a sequel. We would love to have seen that.
I always wondered what it would be like if Manny and her family had moved to America.
Well, it would have been a very different book.
Right. So that might have been a sequel as well. I think my mother would have gone on writing novels forever.
Well, you know, she didn't publish... when did she first publish any of her short stories? Do you know?
I don't know the year. I mean, for years she'd been publishing in literary journals. Before that, she was publishing... She was writing nonfiction for magazines. She was sent around the country to interview people about their lives and write nonfiction articles. And then she started writing short stories, but it was a number of years ago. And then she continued to publish short stories.
What do you like best about Jerusalem as a second language, just personally?
I love the fact that Jerusalem is really a character in the book.
Yeah.
I have not had the opportunity to travel to Israel myself, but now after reading the book, I feel as if I really have. And it was so vibrant, and the experiences were so real that I think it has such universal impact. We've had people comment about the book with very different backgrounds and religions, and I think that it speaks to so many different people. The story is really universal, not just one of Israel.
That search for belonging and for connection. I think it doesn't matter who you are, or what your background or your religion, or that's pretty much a universal search. And also, I did feel as though it transported me. It's a great book for people to read now when they're all feeling locked in, because it's Jerusalem is so alive, the sights and the sounds and the smells and the rhythms. So that really just lingered with me after I finished it.
Yeah, I can tell you, having lived there, she brings it back to life. I feel like I've just gone back.
Yes.
So you must go to Israel, first of all.
That's the worst. I certainly plan to. Absolutely.
As soon as it's reasonably safe to travel again,
right.
God willing.
That'll be the first place that I plan on going.
I want to thank you both for a great visit. The book is called Jerusalem as a Second Language. It's by Rochelle Distelheim. Where can people go to find out more about the book, to find out more about your mom?
Well, she does have a website.
She has a website, and she used... which is rdistelheimauthor.com.
The book is available at the bookstall in Winnetka, Illinois, and on Amazon. And
I believe if you Google the publisher, Abade Publishing, you can find information about her.
Yes, AUBADE Publishing.
And again, it's a great story. It's a terrific novel. Thank you both. Really appreciate it. And, you know, this is a good tribute to your mother's memory as well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. You can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha weekly on Friday night for masked blended Shabbat services, or on Facebook Live, where everybody can come. If you wish to come in person, you may call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675 to request attendance. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus, Soros, you can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Shabbat services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. The Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson. We're holding our services with full music on Facebook Live and for very limited attendance. Live people wearing masks and social distancing as well. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom, with a few select ones also available in blended format. You can access our classes by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. Or going to our website, beitsimchatucson.org. Synagogues at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property, not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend our wonderful services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, now also in blended formats, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses. Those are all taught on Zoom and some in blended format as well. And of course, all of our services on Facebook Live or in blended format. Go to BEITSIMCHATucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community and the fastest-growing synagogue in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Our playout this morning comes for the upcoming Torah portion this Shabbat of Lech Lecha, when God commands Abram to leave his home and journey to the place that God will show him. It's from Israeli Youth Choir director Yonatan Scheinfeld, and it's called Lech Lecha. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Jason Guberman, director of Diarna, the Geomuseum of North African and Middle Eastern Jewish Life, a remarkable resource of online touring of synagogues, communities, and cemeteries throughout the Sephardic and Oriental Jewish world. Jason Guberman is also the executive director of the American Sephardi Federation and a great guest. Don't miss it. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of both health and peace. Oh,
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.